posso iniziare? Che dite?
Buonasera a tutti. Incominciamo ringraziandovi di essere qui. Ci fa molto piacere vedere un pubblico così numeroso e che effettivamente, evidentemente, ha colto l'importanza di questo incontro, che è un incontro molto importante per noi. Noi siamo felici ed orgogliosi di poter ospitare qui il professor Timothy Ingold, che ringraziamo di aver accolto il nostro invito. E ringraziamo altresì i due artisti, Caretto e Spagna, a cui insieme con la Fondazione Spinola Banna abbiamo affidato il compito di immaginare, gestire e portare avanti questo anno di workshop e di residenza per giovani artisti, sfruttando il luogo della Fondazione Spinola Banna, per cui in una contestualizzazione territoriale molto caratterizzata, vicino evidentemente ad un territorio segnato da una storia agricola, segnato da una storia geologica estremamente particolare, e di confrontarsi però, di interrelarsi contemporaneamente ad una storia molto diversa, che è la storia della Gamma, che è un museo che raccoglie la più antica collezione di arte moderna e contemporanea del nostro paese. Questo è il terzo appuntamento realizzato, ideato da Andrea Caretto e Raffaella Spagna. Terzo appuntamento dopo un incontro che ci ha permesso di attraversare lo spazio museale come se potesse essere una specie di disegno, di schema metaforico di quelle che sono le stratificazioni del territorio, pensando con una parte della nostra mente alle grandi stratificazioni geologiche del globo, ma contemporaneamente alla specificità del Pianalto di Poirino, che è il territorio specifico a cui i due artisti hanno deciso di dedicare la loro ricerca e il loro lavoro di residenza con i giovani artisti quest'anno. E il secondo incontro, tenutosi sempre alla GAM, qui alla GAM di Torino, in cui si sono analizzati nella specificità del territorio del Pianalto di Poirino alcune dinamiche del suolo e alcune pratiche agricole. Ora voi capite che questo tipo di approccio permette di guardare alla materia di volta in volta con un occhio estremamente microscopico, estremamente specifico, estremamente legato ad una storia, ad un micro ambiente, ad un micro territorio, e allo stesso tempo allargare l'osservazione quasi ad una contemplazione molto più ampia, che riguarda dinamiche che riguardano ogni territorio, e cioè ogni possibilità di interrelazione tra l'uomo, la sua storia, la cultura e la storia sedimentata, formata, insita e compenetrata nel territorio stesso, per cui ci permette di fare discorsi molto più ampi. E infatti questa sera è l'ottica forse più panoramica e universale che andremo a toccare attraverso questa lezione del professor Ingold. E per me è in qualche modo un piacere poter presentare questa lezione, perché così guardando un po' alle premesse, al piccolo abstract che ci è stato fornito delle parole che verranno dette questa sera, compare prepotente una parola di estrema importanza, e che però quasi per pudore, mi verrebbe da dire, nei decenni passati il mondo dell'arte ha fatto in modo di poterla cancellare, di poterla mettere a parte del nostro campo di lavoro e del nostro campo di ricerca. È una parola un po' solenne, ed è la parola verità. Allora, pensare in questa sala storica di un museo d'arte moderna e contemporanea, di tornare a parlare di ricerca della verità, è qualcosa di estremamente, mi viene da usare questo aggettivo molto semplice, ma molto, molto sincero, molto vero, cioè è forte, ha qualcosa di potente, provare a darsi questo compito nello stesso momento in cui ci diciamo che è una meta che poniamo di fronte a noi, ma che è una meta in se stessa, forse irraggiungibile, ed è quello che abbiamo imparato sin dai banchi del ginnasio quando ci hanno spiegato per la prima volta l'etimologia della parola filosofia. Ma è un compito deflagrante, e dico che torniamo a parlare, a pronunciare questa parola, a interrogarci su questa parola, perché effettivamente è un ritorno, ed è un ritorno soprattutto qui a Torino, dove mi piace ricordare che c'è stato un tempo, e forse anche a sua volta anche quello era un ritorno di pensieri più antichi, ma c'è stato un tempo in cui già ci siamo detti che l'arte e l'interpretazione dell'arte erano strumenti di ricerca della verità, ed è stato detto attraverso le parole di un filosofo dell'Università di Torino, Luigi Pireson, che ci ha insegnato e continua a insegnarci attraverso le sue pagine, che l'arte è un metodo di conoscenza, e per cui l'arte è un metodo di ricerca della verità. Poi nel proseguo, nell'avanzamento degli studi filosofici, ci sono state figure come Umberto Eco, peraltro allievo di Pireson, che ci ha invece raccontato, e aveva ragione di farlo in quel contesto storico, che l'arte non produce conoscenza, perché la conoscenza è frutto della ricerca della verità oggettiva della scienza, ma l'arte semmai produce degli addenda, delle immagini, delle metafore epistemologiche, che in qualche modo rappresentano la visione scientifica del periodo a cui gli artisti appartengono, ma non producono scienza. Ecco che noi questa sera in qualche modo torniamo a ricondurci in una specie di grande ciclo vitale del pensiero, e in modo nuovo, in modo inevitabilmente diverso, come ci spiegherà lo stesso Tim Ingold, torniamo a dirci che l'arte è quello strumento che ci permette anche di conoscere il mondo. Io credo che sia qualcosa di una certa qual rilevanza, e per me è un onore per cui essere qui a presentare il professor Ingold. Prima però di lasciare la parola a lui, vi dico, così come avvertenza, perché voi mentalmente vi prepariate se volete le domande, che alla fine della lecture del professor Ingold ci sarà il tempo per un dibattito, per porre dei quesiti, e questo tempo di riflessione verrà moderato da Alice Benessia, che ringrazio di essere qua, non solo per la collaborazione di questa sera, ma per la collaborazione che già ha dato qui in GAM, non soltanto quest'anno ma anche l'anno precedente. Alice Benessia fa parte del centro di ricerca IRIS dell'Università di Torino, e già con la Spinola Banna e con il coordinamento di Elena Mazzi, che era l'artista a cui abbiamo affidato il progetto l'anno scorso, è stata qui ad aiutarci a tracciare un percorso appunto di ricerca nelle tematiche legate al workshop e alla residenza. E per ultima cosa lascio la parola, senza troppe presentazioni, a Raffaella Spagna, che farà una piccola introduzione e che vi dirà le sue ragioni, le ragioni di Raffaella e di Andrea Caretto per invitare qui il professore per ascoltarlo questa sera. Ovviamente il mio ringraziamento va anche a lei.
Buonasera a tutti, vi ringraziamo moltissimo per essere qui stasera così numerosi. Ringraziamo anche molto la GAM che ci ospita, ad ospitato anche i precedenti interventi, e la Fondazione Spinola Banna, partner del progetto Idea Pianalto, che accoglie così bene le nostre attività in fondazione, e anche tutti i 5 artisti che sono attualmente in residenza. Anche ringraziamo molto la Compagnia di San Paolo, che sta permettendo veramente la realizzazione concreta di tutto questo progetto. Io, Andrea, tutti gli artisti, forse anche voi, siamo contentissimi di essere riusciti finalmente ad avere qui in Italia e a Torino il professor Tim Ingold, che ci ha anche privilegiato di questa presenza con un breve workshop alla Fondazione Spinola Banna di Poerino. Abbiamo passato 2 giorni con il professor Ingold, quindi abbiamo avuto questo modo di convivere con lui e approfittare di queste sue vastissime conoscenze in una serie di lezioni, anche in una camminata, e ovviamente anche in tutte le attività attività quotidiane, di mangiare insieme, quindi è stato veramente per noi un privilegio incredibile. Abbiamo conosciuto il professor Ingold grazie alla segnalazione di una critica d'arte torinese, Giorgino Bertolino, parte del gruppo a titolo, che ci aveva segnalato l'esistenza di questo libro, che è attualmente l'unico libro tradotto in lingua italiana, Ecologia di cultura, della cultura, edito da Meltem Edizione. E dopo averlo letto ci siamo resi immediatamente conto che in qualche modo quegli scritti erano la miglior critica d'arte che poteva essere fatta nei confronti di tutto il nostro lavoro. È accaduto quindi che dopo alcune riflessioni abbiamo deciso di fare un viaggio ad Aberdeen e quindi di andare a visitare personalmente il professor Ingold. Abbiamo anche fatto visita al suo dipartimento all'Università di Aberdeen, e tutto ciò non ha fatto che confermare questa incredibile affinità elettiva. E da quell'anno poi sono seguiti una serie di, come dire, di lunghi anni di separazione e di lavoro in silenzio. Abbiamo continuato ovviamente a leggere, a studiare tutti i suoi nuovi e più recenti testi, ed è molto strano per noi, per me ed Andrea, constatare come anche questa evoluzione nella nostra ricerca, che è essenzialmente una ricerca di, nella pratica del fare arte, abbia costantemente avuto una corrispondenza nel lavoro ovviamente più teorico e concettuale di Tim Ingold. C'è una strana parallelismo per cui scopriamo, dopo aver fatto magari un progetto, che può intercettando un nuovo libro di Tim che in qualche modo aveva già trattato e ovviamente descritto con parole chiarissime, molto limpide e molto essenziali, quello che per noi era il cuore della nostra ricerca in pratica, che però non, effettivamente non sapremmo mai esprimere così bene. E quindi siamo felicissimi di averlo qui oggi e anche di offrirlo a tutti voi. È molto conosciuto in Europa, negli Stati Uniti, in America del Sud, in molte parti del mondo, e in Italia, secondo noi, è giunto il momento di tradurre altri suoi libri e di essere molto più conosciuto. Speriamo che questo dia un nuovo slancio a questa nuova fase della sua ricerca per l'Italia. Grazie a tutti voi, lascio la parola al professor Tim Ingold.
Well, thank you, Raffaella, and everybody. It's an enormous pleasure and honor for me to be here. Yes, thank you for coming. It is a commonplace that scientists do research. We might reasonably ask the scientist to justify his or her research, to explain how it's done, and to disseminate the results. But that research is what scientists do is not in question. But with artists, it's precisely the opposite. I think it would have been unusual in the past for scientists to admit to carrying, sorry, it would have been unusual in the past for artists to carry out research, and even more unusual for the public to recognize it as such. But nowadays, for a variety of reasons, partly institutional, partly to do with funding, but largely connected to changing practices in art itself, more and more artists present what they are doing as research. And this leaves the public puzzled. Are they artists pretending to behave like scientists? And if they are, what are they trying to find out? And what kinds of knowledge do they think their art can contribute that science cannot? And the apparent inability of artists to answer such basic questions only serves to increase public suspicion. What are these artists actually up to when they claim to be doing research and they can't tell us? But in this lecture, I would like to turn these normal expectations upside down. In brief, I'm going to argue that research is fundamentally a practice of art, a practice in which science has consistently fallen short. If scientists truly believe that what they are doing is research, then it is for them to prove it. And this means holding up a spotlight to their own practices and asking difficult questions about the real meaning of research and what it takes for science to live up to its demands. In other words, we can't just let scientists assume that they're doing research. We have to get them to explain what they mean by it. Perhaps if scientists are to regard themselves and to be regarded as engaged in research, they should start behaving a bit more like artists. Indeed, many do, but they are still the exceptions, the unorthodox ones. But following their example would be a first step towards a convergence between science and art that the world in its present juncture badly needs. This doesn't mean, of course, that art should cease to question its own practices. But by resetting the default, by subsuming scientific research under the rubric of art, rather than subsuming artistic research under the rubric of science, I believe that we can restore the balance necessary for their proper integration. Let me suggest an analogy that I think takes us to the heart of the problem. Explore is a word that both scientists and artists often use. Scientists say, we are exploring the universe. Artists say, we're exploring something. But what of explorers themselves? A few years ago, I attended a symposium on perception and exploration held in a small town in the Scottish Highlands. It was attended by local people, hill walkers, a number of artists, including Richard Long, incidentally, and one world-famous mountaineer invited for the occasion. The hill walkers and the artists spoke with great enthusiasm about their exploration of the Highlands, following familiar tracks and trails, some of them very old, created by cattle droving, for example, over previous centuries. Immersed as they were in the landscape, they found in it a source of perpetual wonder and astonishment. The ever-changing skies, the play of light, shadow, and colour, the comings and goings of animals, the sprouting and flowering of plants, intriguing stones and rock formations, even the occasional archaeological find, attesting to the long history of human habitation in the region. There was always something to catch one's attention and to explore further. But when it was the mountaineer's turn to speak, it was with a tone of unmistakable regret. There are no more explorers anymore, he exclaimed, only cavers. Now that every mountain peak had been conquered, many by this man himself, short of starting afresh on another planet, the only future for exploration, he thought, lay underground, in a kind of upside-down mountaineering that would carry the torch of humanity to ever greater depths rather than to more ascendant heights. The only thing we can do is to explore the caves. How could it be, I wondered, as I listened to his speech, that while the hill walkers and the artists could keep on exploring without end, the mountaineer was convinced that it was all over. Evidently, they were relating to their environment in very different ways. To the mountaineer, the world presents itself as terra incognito, already laid out in perpetuity and awaiting the footprint of man. It generally is man rather than woman in these narratives of exploration. With that final step on the summit, the previously unknown peak is converted into one that is known. It is discovered and placed on the map, or in the famous mantra of lunar exploration, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. So the mountaineer, putting his foot where no man has trodden before, implicitly carries the rest of humanity in his wake. That many of these mountains had been walked for generations previously by indigenous people, with a view not to conquest but to supplication, maybe for requesting help from the deities or the ancestors, did not appear to be of concern to our mountaineer. They counted to him no more than the animals that grazed the slopes. They were part of the world, the nature to be conquered. And of course, the same peak could be climbed again and again, but in the mountaineer's book, every climb is a repeat performance that adds nothing to the original discovery. At best, like the replication of an experiment, it offers a kind of confirmation. But that's to assume that the mountain remains forever as it was, on the side of a constant nature, as against the campaigns of human history periodically launched in its conquest. But for the artists and the hill walkers, the landscape of exploration is anything but constant. On the contrary, it is changing all the time. It may certainly be familiar from having been walked many times before, yet every single walk is different. Every walk is a particular joining together of human lives with the lives of plants and animals, with the formation of rocks and stones, with the weather and with the hills themselves. For walkers immersed in this ever-changing landscape, the idea that a hill climbed once is climbed forever is simply absurd. Now, when artists speak of research, they are for the most part implicitly comparing their practice to the explorations of hill walkers. Scientists, by contrast, would equally implicitly compare themselves with mountaineers. So the question is this: to which of these versions of exploration does the concept of research apply? And it should be obvious by now that I'm siding with the artists and the hill walkers. But the choice is not arbitrary. We have to take sides, I believe, if we are to reach an accommodation with the world that is in any sense sustainable. The mountaineer's regret stemmed from a belated acknowledgement on his part of the unsustainability of his own practice. There were no more peaks to climb. All is known. He had nowhere further to go. If research is not simply to be an instrument of colonization, of closing down the world for future generations, or of sending them underground or to other planets, then we have no alternative but to join with its human and non-human inhabitants in the collective task of keeping life going. And that means taking the meaning of research quite literally. Because in its literal sense, research is a second search, an act of searching again, research. Maybe you're looking for something or trying to find something out. Your initial inquiries yielded results that were at best insufficient. Walking in the hills, you may have got a little lost and didn't find the place you remembered and that you were looking for. So you try again, perhaps with a different approach and taking a different path. And again, and again. Every search both doubles up on what you did before and is yet an original intervention that invites a double in its turn. You walk the path that you walked before, but that's an original walk, which you will then walk again, and that in turn will be an original walk, and so it carries on forever and ever, always doubling on what went before. You will likely never find what you seek, for it has a way of receding as fast as you approach, or chameleon-like of altering its character. The mountain, as we've seen, is never the same twice. But you carry on, undeterred, driven by an insatiable desire. It is a desire that seems as strong and as imperative as the will to live. And you call it curiosity. So research is not a technical operation, a particular thing you do in life for so many hours each day. I have recently enjoyed having a grant from the European Research Council, and it has required me to keep up a table in which I have to say how many hours of research I have done each day. And I have developed a technique of putting down random numbers so that they add up to the right total, because the question is meaningless. Research is not something you do for a certain number of hours each day. It is rather a way of living curiously, that is, with care and attention. And as such, it pervades everything you do. So what are you looking for that so evades your grasp? Are you like a detective, hunting down the facts, trying to get to the bottom of what happened? Or like a customs officer, researching the premises for hidden contraband? Or perhaps you're a novelist or a playwright, casting around for ideas from which to build a plot? Or a hill walker, searching for a place you remember? You could be any of these. But as any detective, customs officer, novelist, playwright, or walker will tell you, finding the facts, nailing the ideas, or identifying the right spot will never finally resolve the case. The criminal is convicted in court on the grounds of evidence. He is found guilty on the basis of the facts, but guilt lives on in the unrelenting trials of consciousness, of conscience. It doesn't stop. Smuggled drugs are discovered, yet they have a material afterlife in the minds and bodies of those who may have produced or ingested them. The novel or the play may be completed, but the characters continue to work their way into the experiences and imaginations of readers and audiences alike, carrying on in their own life stories. The walk may be finished, but the place lives on in memory, and so on and on. In short, something always escapes, always overflows our most determined attempts to pin things down. And that slippery, fugitive, and ineffable quality is truth. And research never ends because it is fundamentally a search for truth. Now, for many today, truth is a scary word, better kept inside quotation marks, the truth, if used at all. It conjures up terrifying images of the violent oppression wreaked in the name of truth by those who have appointed themselves as its worldly ambassadors or representatives. But we should not blame truth for the wrongs committed in its name. The fault lies in totalization, the conversion of truth into a monolith that stands eternal like a monument, timeless and fully formed. And this rests on a delusion on the part of its self-appointed guardians that they are themselves above truth, that they are the masters of it, and truth theirs to command. Human history is studded with delusional projects of this kind, each one catastrophic for those subjected to it, and each ultimately smothered by the sands of time. Today, these delusional projects continue. They include massive projects of geoengineering that would fix the planet once and for all in this era of the Anthropocene, heralding a new age of total human control. Research to the contrary, rests on the acknowledgement that we can never conquer truth, any more than we can conquer the living earth. Such conquest is for immortals. But for us, mortal beings, truth is always greater than we are, always beyond what at any moment can be physically determined or grasped within the categories of thought. So truth is inexhaustible. Wherever or whenever we might be, we can still go further. So research offers no final release into the light. Researchers remain ever in the shadows, ever in the dark, stumbling along with no end in sight, following whatever clues afford a passage. Researchers are anxious souls. And this view of research is hardly conducive to optimism, hardly conducive to the belief common among theorists of progress that the best of all possible worlds is only just around the corner. We just have to open one more envelope and there it will be. But while it may not be optimistic, research is always hopeful. There is a difference here between optimism and hope. Research is hopeful because in converting every closure into an opening, every apparent solution into a new problem, it is the guarantor that life can carry on. And for that reason, research is a primary responsibility of the living. So, if research, as I maintain, is the pursuit of truth, and what would it be if it was not? And if truth ever exceeds the given, then there must always be more to research than the collection and analysis of data. It must go beyond the facts. The fact stops us in our tracks and blocks our way. This is how it is, it says to us. Proceed no further. This is the fact. Now, this isn't to suggest that truth lies behind the facts, calling for a superior intelligence armed with theoretical power tools capable of breaking through the surface appearances or ideological mirrors that deceive the rest of us into thinking that we can already tell truth from illusion. There were the days when Marxist philosophers, armed with their high-powered theory, would say, we are all living in an ideological make-believe, but with our power tools we can break through the barriers of ideology and reveal the truth within. And there are still scientists who talk regularly about breakthroughs, that somehow you smash through the surface of the world and discover those secrets that are inside. That's not what I mean. Nor do I want to suggest the truth lies within the facts as some kind of unfathomable essence that will ever hide from us, sunk into itself. That is the view currently being promulgated very vigorously by the proponents of so-called object-oriented ontology. What I want to insist, rather, is that what appear to us in the first instance as blockages turn out, when we search again, that is, in our research, to be openings that let us in. It is as though the fact rotated by 90 degrees, like a door opening. Here's the fact, imagine it turns like this, so that it no longer confronts us face to face, but aligns itself longitudinally with our own movements. And where the fact leads, we follow. Come with us, says the fact. What had once put an end to our search then reappears in research as a new beginning, a way into the world that is not already formed, but is itself undergoing formation. It's not that we have broken through the surface of the world to discover its hidden secrets, but rather, as the doors of perception open, and as we join with things in the relations and processes of their formation, the surface itself vanishes. The truth of this world, then, is not to be found out there, established by reference to objective facts, but is disclosed from within. It is indeed the very matrix of our existence as worldly beings. We can have no knowledge of this truth save by being in it. Knowing in being, in short, is the essence of research. Let me just go back for a moment to our story about the mountain. One of our great Scottish authors, her name is Nan Shepherd, now celebrated with a quotation and a portrait on the Scottish £5 note, wrote about her long stays and journeys and walks that she made in the Cairngorm Mountains of Scotland. She wrote very beautifully and phenomenologically about this experience. It was a long time ago. And she speaks there about how the mountain is not this great thing that sticks up into the air, but is rather something that is made up out of the great granite rock below, the sky above, and between the rock and the sky, birds, flowers, plants, moss, lichen, stones. So going to the Cairngorms, she finds herself going into the mountain, a mountain that consists of the earth and the atmosphere as a totality. Gradually, she writes, I found my way in. So on the Cairngorm, she's not on the mountain, she's not on top of it, she's inside the mountain. Now, this conclusion that one can know the world only by being in it will, of course, be anathema to those who hold that true knowledge of the world can only be had by taking ourselves out of it and by looking at it at a distance. And again, to recall my earlier story, that's how our mountaineer saw it. He showed lots of slides, and I was struck by the fact that his slides consisted either of pictures of these great mountains in the Himalayas or wherever, seen from a distance, so you could see their peak-like shapes, or pictures of men done up in gear, all sorts of gear already, you know, ice axes and rucksacks and goggles, ready to launch their campaigns on this massive presence. So that's how the mountaineer saw it. His pictures were of the mountains he had climbed and of men dressed up in all their gear. And for him, as for many who think like him, mountains are objects, and objectivity is the very hallmark of truth. And it is indeed understandable that in a world where facts often appear divorced from any kind of observation, where it seems that facts can be invented on a whim, propagated through mass media, and manipulated to suit the interests of the powerful, regardless of their veracity, it's not surprising that we are anxious about the fate of truth. To many, it seems that in this era of so-called post-truth, we are cast adrift without an anchor. If we lose our reference to the facts, if we just make the objective truth, if we just make things up and say those are true just because we made them up, we are lost. And we are right to insist that there can be no proper facts without observation. But we are wrong, I believe, to confuse observation with objectivity. Because to observe, it is not enough merely to look at things. We have to join with them and to follow. And it is precisely as observation goes beyond objectivity that truth goes beyond the facts. Now, two things follow from this. First, if research is the pursuit of truth, then it can have nothing specifically to do with innovation. I've been trying to persuade research officers in my university that research and innovation are not exactly the same thing, and they look at me with blank faces as though I must be mad. How could you possibly separate the two? Indeed, it seems like an odd claim to make, because in the language of progressive development, embraced as much by science as by corporate industry, research and innovation seem joined at the hip. What possible meaning can be given to research, they say, if it is not about coming up with new facts or new ideas that were not previously within the compass of human knowledge? Is research not intended to enlarge the compass? How can we possibly progress by a way of research if we keep on rediscovering what we already knew? Indeed, for contemporary science and industry, locked into the global economy of knowledge, as it is, in which only innovation sells, truth often appears to take second place to novelty. It doesn't matter whether what you've found is true or not, so long as it's new. The critical thing is to demonstrate how this idea, or that fact, exceeds or overtakes what was previously thought or previously known. But this only begs the question of how to decide whether an idea or a fact is new or not. This morning, I had a brilliant idea as I was writing this lecture, and I thought to myself, ha! History has been made this morning at my desk. But how do I know? I would have to trawl through all the ideas that anybody has ever had in history to check whether anybody has had it before. And I'm not sure whether that's something that I could easily do. Because so novelty in any absolute sense can only be demonstrated by comparing our results with everything that has gone before. So do we, every time we come up with a result, a new idea or a new observation, do we have to trawl through all the ideas that have ever been thought or facts that have ever been noted to check that it has never previously been proposed or recorded? And what on earth would be the point of doing so anyway? It's rather like the mountaineer checking that no one before has scaled a particular peak. If it turned out that someone has, then his claim to have discovered it would risk being discredited. An extraordinary amount of effort in science is devoted to trying to demonstrate the novelty of discovery. That seems to be much more important than demonstrating anything about truth. But not only is this, for the most part, virtually impossible in practice, it is also ludicrous in principle. And this is because the world itself does not stand still while we subject it to repeated examination. Nor do we, being part of that world, remain still while we are examining it. As we've already seen with hills and mountains, ideas and things have lives. They carry on. And it is no more possible to revisit exactly the same idea or to rediscover exactly the same thing than it is, in the famous analogy of Heraclitus, to step twice into the running waters of the same river. In short, nothing is ever new because nothing ever precisely repeats. Research, knowing in being, means joining with the ways of the world and following them wherever they go. And like the river, like the mountain, like life, they have no final destination. So that's the first thing. If research is the pursuit of truth, it can have nothing specifically to do with innovation. The second thing is that curiosity in research is a practice of care. In fact, it should be obvious that curiosity and care go together in the attention we pay to things. It should be obvious from the fact that both words, curiosity and care, share the same etymological root, that is, from the Latin curare. Yet in the practice of science, curiosity and care are commonly separated. For scientists, it is a condition of objectivity that they should refuse any relationship, any form of involvement whatever, with the things or phenomena that capture their attention. And this condition of separation, of immunization from contact, is generally met by means of what is called methodology. Methodology meaning a rigid set of procedures or protocols expressly designed to immunize researchers from direct contact with the materials of study. Indeed, the competition for innovation in the knowledge economy has given rise to something approaching a methodological arms race, driving scientists ever further from their objects. Everybody saying, my methodology is more robust than yours. Oh no, mine is even more robust. And the more robust you get, the harder the science, the more you're driven into your own sphere, detached from the objects of your investigation. So the scientific ideal of curiosity is what they call blue sky research, in which investigators are free from all commitment and responsibility towards what they study, simply to follow their own bent. It is for others to worry about how their results might be applied, if at all. Don't ask scientists about that. They will say it's not their job. However, if truth lies beyond objectivity, then there must come a point in its pursuit when, in our observation, the things we study begin to tell us how to observe. In allowing ourselves into their presence, rather than holding them at arm's length, that is, in attending to them, we find that they are also guiding our attention. Our eyes and ears, hands and minds absorb into their ways of working a perceptual acuity that is attuned to their particular ways of moving, feeling, and of being. I know this very well from my own childhood. I'm the child of a mycologist. My dad was a student of aquatic fungi. These were microscopic organisms that he collected from the scum that collected on the sides of rivers, and he would look at this scum under the microscope and discover new species of fungi, and he would draw them. So he would have the fungus under the microscope, and beside him a white sheet of so-called Bristol board, very high quality thin card, and mapping pen and a bottle of Indian ink. And with that mapping pen and Indian ink, as he looked down the microscope, he would draw the precise form of the fungus, following it, and sometimes following different stages of its development. And we could see, as his children, although he never would admit to it, that he loved his fungi, and the way in which he loved his fungi was by almost looking as if he were a fungus himself. He had become a fungus, and he was following the lines of that fungus. His familiarity with these organisms had not just affected what he was looking at, they had become part of the way he looked, the way he observed, and the way he drew, and the gestures that he used. So I know that very deeply from my childhood experience. So attending to the ways of the fungus or whatever, we also respond to them as they indeed respond to us. So research then becomes a practice of what I call correspondence. By that I don't mean matching one thing with another, but I mean two things going along together, or two or more things going along together and responding to each other as they go. As, for example, lines of melody in polyphonic music or in a fugue, where each line is carrying on and all the time responding to the other lines that are going along at the same time. Or when we, in the old days, used to write letters to one another to talk about how we were feeling, we would have a correspondence. And it is through corresponding with things that we care for them. Correspondence is a labour of love, giving back what we owe to the world for our own existence as beings within it. And research as correspondence in this sense is not just what we do, but what we undergo. It is, in that sense, a form of experience. Because in experience, things are with us in our thoughts, dreams, and imaginings, and we are with them. Now, in practice, scientists, just like the rest of us, are immersed in the life world. Just like hillwalkers, just like Nan Shepherd in the Cairngorms, they're inside the mountain and are ever attentive and responsive to the rustlings and whisperings of their surroundings. The chemist, Friedrich August Kekulé, in a lecture recalling his discovery of the benzene molecule, offered this advice to every young scientist. This was at the end of the 19th century. Note every footprint, every bent twig, every fallen leaf. Then, he said, you will see where next to plant your feet. So for Kekulé, science was a sort of wayfaring, or as he called it, pathfinding. So corresponding with things in the processes of their formation, rather than merely being informed by what has already precipitated out, the pathfinder not only collects, but accepts what the world has to offer. And it's in this more humble profession, I believe, rather than in arrogating to itself the exclusive authority to represent a given reality, it's in this more humble profession that scientific inquiry, I believe, can converge with artistic sensibility as a way of knowing in being. Because in practice, never mind in theory, but in practice, scientists are differentiated as much as artists are, and indeed people everywhere, by the specificities of their experience and by the skills arising from them, not by the territorial demarcation of fields of study. So science, when it becomes art, is both personal and charged with feeling. Its wisdom is born of imagination and experience, and its manifold voices belong to each and everyone who practices it, not to some transcendent authority for which they serve indifferently as spokespersons. So scientists can speak with their own voices. They don't have to speak on behalf of something else which is greater than they are. And they can speak with their own voices because those voices are sensible and attuned to what they study. And where scientific pathfinding joins with the art of research, to grow into a knowledge of the world is at the same time to grow into the knowledge of one's own self. So it is here, I believe, that we can begin to see where science can converge with art. Long divided along a split between fact and fantasy, or truth and illusion, science and art have commonly been supposed to strain in opposite direction. Science deals with the facts, art, fantasy. Science digs down into the bedrock of objective reality. Art takes flight into the realms of imagination. Science is about objects, art about subjects. And if science needs art, according to this standard view, it is merely to give the mind freedom to roam, to come up with novel ideas. So Kekulé, for example, said, and whether this actually happened we don't know, but he said that he fell asleep in his chair and had a dream of snakes whirling around and eating each other's tails. And he woke from the dream, and there, fully formed in his head, was the structure of the benzene molecule. But that was just an idea, a free-floating subjective idea that had come into a dream. Then he had to test it against the facts, and only then did it enter into the domain of science. So the normal view is, yes, scientists need imagination, they need art, they need ways to think outside the box so that they will come up with novel ideas that can then be tested against the facts. But it's only at that second stage of the test that we enter science proper. Only when tested against the facts can ideas born of the imagination lay claim to truth. And if it were so, if it were really so, that research is about the establishment of such objective claims, then clearly there could be no research that is not scientific, and no artist could be claimed to be doing research. But if truth lies beyond the facts, then science can only become research only insofar as it is willing to forego objectivity and to follow the way of art into a worldly correspondence that foregrounds the unison of imagination and experience in a world to which we attend and that attends to us. It would be for science, then, to join with art in the pursuit of truth as a way of knowing in being through practices of curiosity and care. The pursuit of truth as a way of knowing in being through practices of curiosity and care, there, finally, lies my definition of research. Thank you.
Sia per voi, sia per naturalmente anche Tim Ingold, per poi lasciare spazio a una conversazione. Quindi quello che rapidamente cercherò di aprire sono questioni per questa zona e quella zona della sala. Ringrazio ovviamente la GAM, ringrazio Fondazione Spinelli, ringrazio i cari amici Raffaella Spagna della Caretto per l'invito. Sono qui in realtà in rappresentanza di IRIS, il centro di ricerca interdisciplinare sulla sostenibilità dell'Università di Torino. Proprio perché in rappresentanza di IRIS inizierò queste tre questioni che pongo sia a voi che a lui. Sono questioni che hanno a che fare con quello che abbiamo appena ascoltato. Si potrebbero aprire, si apriranno immagini moltissime strane. I famosi 90 gradi, l'apertura verso la realtà, sono stati molteplici, almeno per me, nell'esperienza sia di interagire prima con lui che nel risentirlo adesso. Però sarò appunto, cercherò di essere breve, una questione che riguarda la sostenibilità, proprio perché IRIS è il luogo, questo caso che rappresenta un centro tra l'altro di ricerca, quindi la parola ricerca è fondamentale, una questione che ha a che fare con l'arte e una questione che ha a che fare con la scienza, tra le mille che vengono in mente, che verranno in mente anche poi a voi. Quella che ha a che fare con la sostenibilità in realtà ha a che fare con una parola che Tim Ingold ha usato variamente durante il suo talk, che è la parola responsabilità. L'idea della sostenibilità è, diciamo, mainstream, l'idea dominante, quella che noi dobbiamo agire responsabilmente oggi per sostenere le generazioni future. Quest'idea, cioè l'idea di prevedere il futuro e la possibilità di agire responsabilmente sta nella possibilità di prevedere il futuro. Tutto questo vuol dire che la sostenibilità è una scienza e non è un'arte, questo nell'idea dominante. È basata sul dobbiamo risolvere i problemi in modo responsabile conoscendo i fatti, a disposizione. Pensate al cambiamento climatico, dobbiamo raccogliere tutti i dati per poter decidere responsabilmente come agire, per avere un futuro giusto, tra virgolette. E questo presume, quindi, fonda l'idea di responsabilità sulla possibilità di prevedere il futuro. Naturalmente questo è molto complicato nel momento in cui questo futuro è complesso e in realtà più noi conosciamo, più cerchiamo di conoscere il mondo intorno a noi e più questioni si aprono. La questione quindi è riprendere un po' l'idea di responsabilità e vedere se invece l'arte ci può venire in soccorso. Nel chiacchierare e dialogare con Timingo prima di questo incontro mi è venuta in mente una definizione di responsabilità che ho avuto l'occasione di trovare dentro un libro che ha a che fare con l'arte, un dialogo tra Joseph Beuys e Volker Arland proprio sul significato dell'arte. E in questo dialogo si dice: che cos'è la responsabilità? La responsabilità è l'abilità di rispondere. Nel parlarne con Tilingo lui mi ha ricordato che anche John Cage aveva questo tipo di visione dell'idea di responsabilità. Quindi la responsabilità in senso moderno, tradizionale, che è a fondamento della sostenibilità, tra virgolette, mainstream, che è quella di dover prevedere il futuro, cosa impossibile, e invece questa possibilità che si possa considerare la responsabilità come la capacità di imparare a rispondere, quindi corrispondere forse nelle parole di Timingo. E come si fa a imparare questo? Come artisti, come scienziati, come cittadini, impegnati ognuno nella propria vita, nella propria esistenza. Stasera abbiamo avuto qualche spunto riguardo. La seconda questione che ha a che fare con l'arte viene da un'esperienza che ho fatto l'anno scorso. Iris ha collaborato, come accennava all'inizio, abbiamo raggruppato con la Fondazione Spinola Banne, con la Gamma. Anche l'anno scorso in questo progetto di alta formazione per artisti ho avuto l'occasione di collaborare con una delle partecipanti, una giovane artista, Chiara Sgaramella, e all'epoca lei era interessata all'etimologia delle parole, cosa che qui di nuovo è venuta fuori molto questa sera, e si occupava nel suo progetto di arte, ecologia, sostenibilità, eccetera. Quindi abbiamo creato nella nostra conversazione abbiamo creato un piccolo glossario e siamo andati a cercare l'etimologia di alcune parole, prima fra tutte arte, che io avevo già in qualche modo ricercato varie volte, però nel ricercarla una volta insieme a lei abbiamo trovato questa radice, prima ancora della radice latina, ars artis, la radice sanscrita ar, che significa mettere in moto, andare verso. E in qualche modo di nuovo qui, quando ho avuto modo di dialogare con Tim Ingold, questa etimologia in qualche modo ha molto a che fare con il significato della ricerca, che lui oggi è la ricerca della verità. Quindi in qualche modo l'arte sembra davvero in questo senso, andando alla radice della parola, essere fondante rispetto alla ricerca della verità posta come lui la pone, cioè come dialogo, andare verso il mondo, corrispondere col mondo. In realtà, e qui un pochino di provocazione, forse non verrà anche da voi, la possibilità che in realtà questa radice si sia persa, che così come la scienza, anche l'arte, nel mondo contemporaneo, è travolta, sovolta dal flusso del mercato, dal flusso del nostro sistema economico, anche se non produce armi, almeno ufficialmente, come la scienza, come la tecnoscienza, però nello stesso tempo a sua volta è vittima o comunque complice di un sistema che porta verso il contrario di un certo senso di quello che abbiamo sentito qui, e quindi la produzione di fatti, la produzione di opere intese come prodotti, e anche qui la ricerca sempre di nuove idee o la paura che qualche artista possa rubare un'idea. Questa è forse un'altra questione, domanda. Ci sono molti artisti in sala, quindi magari si potrebbe aprire un minimo di dialogo rispetto a questo. Quindi l'arte a sua volta non è così al di fuori forse del mondo, diciamo così, nel quale la scienza è immersa. E la terza questione, che invece riguarda la scienza, è, come dire, un corollario, comunque un'apertura verso la possibilità di considerare che il problema, se vogliamo, dell'oggettività è il problema del rendersi conto che la scienza deve fare a meno dell'oggettività, che è qualcosa di avversivo in un certo modo. Per gli scienziati, ci sono anche molti scienziati in sala. Gli altri cardini, diciamo così, del metodo scientifico sono la certezza, l'oggettività è il primo, uno dei, la certezza e l'universalità. I tre pilastri che danno un'autorità, autorità sulla quale poggiano comodamente gli scienziati, che operano, come diceva Tim Ingold, e hanno la possibilità di operare senza sentirsi responsabili, anche se oggi si parlava di ricerca e innovazione, l'acronimo, uno degli acronimi più, come dire, che si sentono di più nel mondo della ricerca di oggi è ricerca e innovazione responsabile, RRI, che viene dalla Commissione Europea. Quindi la responsabilità rientra anche nel mondo degli scienziati, ma con un timbro, diciamo così, ex post, per cui si deve fare una sorta di checklist di responsabilità per poi arrivare a essere ufficialmente responsabili. Torno però al punto, il punto è che la certezza e l'universalità a loro volta sono molto in discussione nel mondo di oggi, prima perché i fatti non sono mai certi e ce ne rendiamo conto, non sono mai stati. I fatti della scienza non sono mai stati certi, ma oggi la questione è particolarmente problematica proprio perché abbiamo a che fare con delle cose che testiamo direttamente nel mondo. Pensate di nuovo all'esperimento sul clima che stiamo facendo tutti insieme e che non sappiamo come andrà a finire. L'incertezza in gioco non solo non diminuisce, ma aumenta esponenzialmente più noi cerchiamo di conoscere. Allora, come possiamo decidere responsabilmente come artisti, come cittadini, come scienziati, in un mondo sempre più incerto? E l'universalità è l'altra questione messa in discussione, perché sempre di più abbiamo bisogno di mettere in relazione, di corrispondere col mondo, di corrispondere e metterci in relazione con sistemi di conoscenza, sistemi di sapere diversi da quelli tra virgolette ufficiali, che hanno l'autorità ufficiale. Si parla sempre di esperti che hanno l'autorità universale della scienza. Quindi volevo chiedere anche questo, non solo a Tim Ingold, ma anche agli scienziati e ricercatori in sala, qualche riferimento rispetto a questo. Smetto, avrei tante cose, voglio lasciare che poi. Grazie.
Respond first to those questions and then throw it open. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Alicia. I will briefly respond to the three points that she made, but I don't want to do so at length because I want you to have an opportunity to say things, ask things yourselves. I hope we have as much time as possible for a general discussion. I want to hear from all of you. So there are three issues. One is about sustainability, or perhaps rather about responsibility. The second is about art, and the third is about science. I'm of entirely the same mind as Alicia here, that that responsibility is key to any kind of thinking about sustainable futures. My concern is that when we think about sustainability, it should be I call it sustainability of everything. That is, we cannot think of sustainability for some at the cost of others. The only viable form of sustainability is one that allows room for everything that can possibly be, not only now, but in the future. Of course, things that we don't know what they will be. So it must be about allowing life, in some sense, to carry on and to allow room for everything. And everything is not countable. Everything is rather like the sky, a cloudy sky. You can't count the number of clouds in the sky because things are changing, differentiating, moving about all the time. Everything is an entire field, continuous field of difference and differentiation. And what we need is to allow this difference and differentiation to continue. On the question of responsibility, this is an ethical question, of course, but my argument would be that responsibility depends always on responsiveness. That is, we cannot have responsibility unless we are able, capable of responding and being responded to, answering to things around us. And that depends on a certain sensitivity to others, an ability, a perceptual ability to correspond with other beings, with the world around us. I am concerned that much of the discussion about the ethics of sustainability is carried on in such a way that we talk about responsibility in sort of almost judicial terms, in quasi-legal terms, without thinking about the responsiveness that must underpin it. Almost as though if we had enough ethical codes of conduct, that would substitute for that responsiveness that I think is necessary to support sustainability. So that's on the first question, because there's a lot more to be said about it. On the etymology of art is the etymology of the word art is a fascinating one. I haven't taken it back as far as Alicia has to Sanskrit. I did take it back as far as Greek, where this particle, ar, is a key part of the Greek word harmonia, from which, of course, we get the word harmony, and the Greek aravisko, to join. And to me, this word is fundamentally about joining things. And the question then is, what does it mean to join with, to join in, to join up? There are all sorts of different ways of joining. And my argument here would be that we need to think about how to join with things rather than with how to join things up. Bureaucrats love to talk about joined up thinking and complain that we don't have enough of it. But if everything was joined up, then nothing could move, nothing could live, nothing could grow. It's because things join with rather than up that that life can continue. And that joining with, I think, is the kind of thing that a lot of contemporary art, Joseph Beuys, I suppose, would be an example of this, is enjoining us to, encouraging us to do. Then finally, on science and the question of certainty and universality, again, I agree with what Alicia is saying, that certainty and universality are very key concepts for science, and that they're also very dangerous. We live in an uncertain world, but we shouldn't, I think, regard that uncertainty in a negative sense. That is to say, uncertainty means not knowing, but it doesn't mean ignorance. And there's a difference between not knowing how things will go and ignorance, that is simply being just having a little comprehension of the world. Not knowing is recognizing that we're not masters of the universe, that we are part of the world that is going its own way, and to some extent we have to submit to that. And I would argue that submission is of the essence of wisdom, and that there is a distinction to be made between wisdom and knowledge. So lack of knowledge is ignorance, but wisdom lies in the uncertainty of not knowing. Knowledge has a way of protecting us. We arm ourselves with knowledge in order to protect ourselves from reality. There's one author who said that, Scottish author, who said that the trouble is that when you know too much about things, what you see is your own knowledge and not the thing itself. That we can surround ourselves with knowledge like a baron inside a castle and defend ourselves with knowledge against the world. But to be wise, we have to take down the walls of the castle and expose ourselves, actually to bring things, stop explaining things away all the time, and bring things into our presence so that we can deal with them directly and learn from them and listen to what they have to tell us. Just finally, one example, because it's fun, this is if you have an unruly teenage child who is shouting and making a lot of noise and so on, you know the worst thing to say as a parent is, "I was there once. I completely understand." That is to put the child in its place. Say, "There you are, we put you in a context, we've explained your moods, your passions, we're not going to deal with them." Whereas what the child is wanting is for us to pay attention for once, that they are there, and they have things to say, and feelings to express, and they want us to respond to them. And that's the difference. If we know too much, we can become extremely unwise. And I rather think that at the present juncture in history, never has so much knowledge been harnessed to so little wisdom. But those are my answers. Throw it open if we can.
Se devo riaccenderlo, ecco.
Forse una rapida reazione mentre arriva il microfono e che mi sembra, diciamo, immediata quello che ha appena detto Timingo, della idea che dal futuro, dall'idea di questa idea di prevedere il futuro per agire responsabilmente, per essere sostenibile, eccetera, tutto questo ci riporta al presente, imparare a vivere nel presente, l'esempio del bambino, rendersi consapevoli che le cose intese come gli esseri viventi, le viventi sono qui e il problema è qui oggi, sempre facendo le veci di Iris in questo momento, delle questioni di sostenibilità non sono nel futuro ma sono nel presente, quindi responsiveness, la possibilità di imparare a rispondere, la saggezza invece della conoscenza, la capacità di stare presenti, attenti a ciò che ci circonda, in corrispondenza con ciò che ci circonda, è molto più sensato rispetto a aspettare indefinitamente di sapere come andare al futuro per agire in modo sostenibile. Si rischia di aspettare Godot, di aspettare che di risolvere il futuro, cercando continuamente di prevederlo.
Mi taccio.
Io ho una domanda molto istintiva che mi è venuta in mente mentre parlava ed è appunto chi è all'interno di questo paradigma della verità, colui che mente in arte, e se ha senso poter dire che c'è qualcuno che mente soprattutto nell'ambito della verità basata sui fatti abbiamo sempre delle condizioni di verità, abbiamo quando invece si tratta di fatti che si devono adeguare alle nostre espressioni abbiamo delle condizioni di sincerità, in qualche modo il rapporto con la nostra mente, quando si tratta di mantenere degli impegni abbiamo delle condizioni di felicità. Nell'ambito, se noi decidiamo di non trattare la verità come una verità basata sui fatti, ma una verità come corrispondenza, come facciamo a trovare queste condizioni che a questo punto mi viene da pensare non si dovrebbero più chiamare condizioni, ma dovrebbero chiamarsi in un altro modo, magari dei segnali, così. E l'ultima domanda è, all'interno di una verità, oltre ai fatti, ma che comunque all'interno dell'oggetto della verità oltre ai fatti, ma che comunque richiede uno sforzo immaginativo molto forte, come possiamo pensare la nostra conoscenza modale, quindi di ciò che non è qui davanti a noi, ma di ciò che potrebbe essere e di ciò che non potrebbe essere diverso da com'è.
Wow. That's a really, really difficult question. First of all, here's my minimal definition of truth. For me, truth is the unison of imagination and experience in a world that, to which we are alive and that is alive to us. So it's bringing imagination and experience together, not separating them out. So the imagination is sort of fantasy and the experience is fact. And it's situating that unison of imagination and experience in an active perceptual relation with the environment that we're in. Now, you raised the question about truth and lies, and the difficulty there, I think, is that when you start bringing in the issue about lying, then you're assuming that truth is propositional. That is to say, you make a proposition, and then you say, okay, the sky is red, true or false? Are you saying the truth or are you lying? Lying doesn't make sense unless you're thinking about truth in that propositional way. And it's quite interesting that there are cognitive scientists, for example, who experiment with the intelligence of non-human primates and have been trying to find out whether or not chimpanzees can tell lies by doing clever things with bananas. And in the experiment, the chimpanzee puts a banana in one box and pretends it's in another, and this kind of thing. And it's interesting that in the vision of those cognitive scientists, that's what truth means. It's purely propositional, because that's the kind of truth that they work with. But if you took another example that I used really in passing, of the criminal who's convicted in court, who is proved by the facts to have committed a crime, so he is declared guilty, and that then is a propositional truth. You know, you are guilty of this crime. He might have lied in court and said he did things that he didn't, or didn't do things that he did, but he's been declared guilty, fact. But then what is guilt? Guilt is a state of conscience. It's a state of mind, which presumably that criminal has to live with in some sort of way. It's not a fact. So that's the sense in which the truth for that individual is something that goes way, way beyond the mere fact of his conviction in court and the mere facts of what he did and led to that conviction. Just one other thing. You talked about signals and innuendos. And this is another thing. Again, if I may use an example, I once had to go, because as a university professor, I have to periodically appraise my staff. That is, we have yearly meetings in which according to the management we have, I have to meet with every member of staff and talk about their objectives and how things have gone with them. And in order to do these so-called appraisals, I had to go through a training course. And the expert in the training course started saying that, well, when you're sitting down with your colleague there, it's most important to observe their body language. Don't listen to what they're saying. Look at their body and see what that's giving off, because that's what they're really saying. And I was so angry that I stormed out. I said, I'm talking to a colleague here. I want to listen to what he has to say. I don't want to listen to him for what he has to say about him or her. I'm not a spy. I'm not trying to discover some kind of underlying thing. If I'm going to treat this as a fellow human being like me, then we are going to talk. And I'm not going to start looking at hidden signals which might reveal some kind of underlying sense that puts me above them. So that shows that there is a political dimension to the discourse on truth, which I think one way to deal with that dimension is to bring things back into presence, a bit less interpretation, a bit more presence. But that's my answer. Did you want to add anything?
Uh, Volevo aggiungere un'altra parola che credo sia utile, una parola che tu usi molto, che fa parte del tuo lavoro, ma che oggi non è emersa esplicitamente. Cioè, io penso che le questioni che sono state presentate sull'arte, sulla scienza, sulla ricerca, e anche queste domande, questo dibattito, e poi alla fine hanno a che fare con la questione dell'identità. È un'altra parola filosofica molto, molto importante. Cioè, con una questione ontologica, l'identità. Per dirla in modo molto secco, non so se sei d'accordo con questo, cioè, per essere sostenibili, cioè responsabili, bisogna imparare a perdere continuamente la propria identità. Credo che si potrebbe dire in questo modo. E questo vale tanto per l'identità collettiva dei saperi, l'arte, la scienza, e poi però parte dalle questioni che riguardano l'identità individuale, no? Questa domanda di chi sono, che poi in molti libri tuoi, questa questione del mondo senza oggetti, dell'ontologia fluida. Ecco, l'educazione, come imparare a perdere la propria identità. Questo per fare un collegamento un po' esterno, e sempre per parlare di ricerca, come ripetere passi continuamente tutta la vita. Io credo che questo tipo di educazione, questo tipo di perceptual engagement, no? Come viene chiamato a volte, è molto vicino per certi versi a ciò che viene nel taoismo o nel buddismo, nel taoismo, questa idea dell'abbassamento dell'ego, della perdita dell'ego. Questo ha a che fare con la politica, perché ha a che fare con l'accademia, con le differenze disciplinari. E allora qui volevo dire una cosa su una questione molto politico-accademica. Io ho provato in questi anni, insieme ad altri amici, colleghi, a far tradurre alcuni libri di Ingold in italiano, vari editori, e la prima cosa che viene detta è: non è tanto un po' antropologo, un po' filosofo, non si sa dove mettere. Questo è un problema che riguarda la questione dell'identità, la politica e l'incapacità poi di superare il tema delle categorizzazioni. Joseph Beuys diceva una frase che sembrava arrogante, ma si può interpretare in questo modo: dove sono io, lì c'è l'università. Quando parlava di accademia e di università, là dove io sono, lì c'è l'università. Allora, in questo senso, se penso che potrebbe essere così una riflessione anche ulteriore da fare per rinforzare questa idea che l'arte e la scienza alla fine condividono un destino comune.
Scusami, solo una, cerco di fare la cuscinetto. Forse potresti dirci chi sei e così capiamo meglio il...
Mi chiamo Nicola
Perugno. Ok. E no, perché sei un filosofo, questo volevo dire che forse è importante.
Non sono un filosofo, ma faccio.
Fai il filosofo, scusami, l'identità. Perché... No, e l'altra questione appunto sull'identità volevo solo capire, chiarire meglio per chi non è filosofo in sala, e per me anche, la questione dell'identità individuale, e no, scusami, o in certo modo mi sembra che le due cose sono andate insieme nel quello che hai detto. Il perdere la propria identità individuale, quindi il discorso sulla perdita dell'ego da una parte, e poi però invece l'istituzione, l'identità dell'istituzione o della disciplina. Entrambe le cose, mi posso immaginare, vanno sfumate, forse anche nel suo lavoro. Volevo solo chiarire forse un po' il...
Grazie.
Prego.
Ok, thanks for that, Nicolai. I am an anthropologist. Anthropologists, but perhaps anthropologists differ a lot from one another every day, so I'm a particular sort of anthropologist, and my own view of anthropology is that it is philosophy with the people in, by which I mean that the trouble with a lot of philosophy is that it is caught up in its own world of canonical texts to which it refers. And anthropology, for me, is a way of doing philosophy, but a way of doing philosophy in the world, rather than inside the enclosure of a textual tradition. So in that sense, I agree entirely with Joseph Beuys in saying that the world is our university. If we attend to things, respond to things, use those things to think about life, or whatever we want to think about, then that, for me, is doing anthropology. And it need not be just with other human beings anymore. Although anthropology has this word anthropos in, most anthropologists now have the feeling that they don't want to draw a rigid boundary around human beings. And so it can be, you can be thinking, conversing, corresponding with anything, so long as some sort of attention is being paid and some understanding is coming out of it. On the question of identity, this is it's one of the most contested notions, as we know, in politics at the moment. I myself would make a distinction between relational identity and attributional identity. So identity, in one sense, is simply the answer to the question, well, who are you? And to answer that question, the only way to answer that question, if somebody asks it, who are you, is to start telling your life history, the history of yourself, the relations you've had, places you've been in, and so on. And I don't have a problem with that. In that sense, identity is simply another word for story. Your story. This is my story. And it's carrying on, still carrying on. And that's okay. The problem comes when a relational identity is converted into an attributional one. And an attributional identity is saying, you are who you are because you possess certain attributes inside here, which you also have in common with other people who share that identity and want to defend it against outsiders. As soon as you get that, then community is no longer an open-ended thing of co-giving, what this really means, that becomes a closed interest group. And that is exactly the problem that we're having with identity politics at the moment, that people, particularly when they feel that their relational identity, that who they are, is threatened by powers, superior powers, often beyond their control, tend to turn in on themselves and convert that relational identity into an attributional one to form closed interest groups that define themselves as against outsiders. And as you all know, we're seeing a great deal of that at the moment. I think I'll leave it there.
Forse abbiamo sentito due filosofi, qualche altro intervento, sono, abbiamo ancora 10 minuti, poi almeno dobbiamo lasciare il treno.
Is it okay if I speak in English?
Of course.
Okay. First of all, thank you for raising so many amazing points of debate and a lot of like food for thought. And just on this last intervention, what I'm asking myself and kind of asking everyone is, how do we start making a difference? Where do we start to change? Because all these points of hopefully more and more people waking up these realities as we kind of stuck behind some illusions where we've lost connection to our own codes, our own words, and even the terms of responsibility becomes, as you said, something that becomes even like a legal term. And we've lost connection to what is our own ability to respond to what life is happening. And I thought like this was kind of like really nice synchronicity, because what you said about the etymology of the word, it's something that I came across a couple of years ago, the ability to respond to life. So then my question is, because everything is a matter of perspective, even the difference between art and science, they're so much closer and they're so alike, and we kind of miss the perspective of it, because a scientist, just by the nature of the research that they're doing, they're mainly looking through a very small lens. So just by the nature of it, you're narrowing down the field of view that you have. And then he thinks that that is the only thing that exists. But then when you enhance the pictures that were created by looking through a very small hole, you get geometries that are across everything, like designs, art, spirituality. They're common to kind of many different realities. So I thought, and this word really works really well in English, the idea of shifting perspective, and we're used to react to what is happening to us or around us, and how do we change the way we see it by shifting that C inside the letter and putting it in front of the word, so create instead of react. And so that's kind of my point, where do we start?
Okay, thank you. These are big issues. I've noted down four things here, and I'll just respond with them. There is the basic question, what do we do? And it's a difficult question to answer. My sense is that we are currently witnessing the death throes of the global neoliberal economic and political order. And we don't know what's coming next. And we don't know how much damage is going to be done in the course of its destruction. But I'm virtually certain that this neoliberal order, which everybody knows is manifestly unsustainable, it's generated massive inequalities of wealth, it's made the large proportion of people on the planet surplus to requirements, and it has devastated the environment. So this is unsustainable. It may be that it's falling apart now, it maybe will fall apart in the future, but we have already now to think about and work towards whatever is coming next, rather than wait for the crash to happen and then pick up the pieces afterwards. That's why I think it's really important for us to be now thinking, not optimistically, but hopefully, remember that distinction, about what kind of world we want and how we're going to help shape it for future generations. A world outside the frame of neoliberal economics. And that's something we can all do. The second thing, I think, is to choose one's friends carefully. We can demonize the institutions of science, and I have to some extent done that and accused them of connivance with that neoliberal order, as indeed it has done, connivance with corporations, with the industry. But one should not demonize scientists. And there's such a difference between science and scientists. Science is a rather rigid set of institutions that control funding, publication, jobs, and careers. Scientists are living people who are passionate about their work and feel as deeply about the things they work with as any artist does. They are really artists, but the institutions of science do not allow them to be so. And for them, I think it's a growing source of frustration. So that we should make friends with the scientists and tackle the institutional issues around science. I think that's strategically the case. But these big orders, just like we had the banking collapse in 2008, in 2008 when the banks collapsed, I predicted that very soon we'd see the collapse of big science. It hasn't happened yet, but I'm pretty sure it will. And we'll find that it too rests on a series of counterfeits. And I'm reminded about what happened with the extinction of the dinosaurs, that when the dinosaurs were large and animals became extinct, it was the small mammals who inherited the earth. And I like to think of art and also of anthropology and some other disciplines like that as the small mammals that are ready to take over when the dinosaurs collapse. And I'm always reminded of what I think will turn out to be the most famous, you know, a typical small mammal is a mouse. And I'm reminded of what will turn out to be the most famous small mouse in history, the one who ate through the cables feeding electricity to the Large Hadron Collider so that it was put out of action for 6 months. That mouse, for me, is an absolute hero, because the Large Hadron Collider, to me, is a monument to scientific hubris. It professes to provide, to come up in the end with a theory that will explain everything about the universe. In that explained universe, there will be no place for us. It is a machine for the end of the world. And that mouse, by biting through the cable, at least postponed that by 6 months, which was a pretty good thing for a mouse to do. Now, if a mouse can do that, just think what we can do collectively, together, if we put our minds to it. And then, finally, about shifting perspectives. Part of the problem with science, and indeed scientists, is that they become very, very specialised. They look at their own particular thing and can't see anywhere else. But that's because they're thinking of a field of inquiry in a territorial way. So you split the territory into finer and finer and finer divisions. But so we need to stop thinking about knowledge as a form of territorial control and conquest, and think of it more as a way of looking into the world. And then you can see the whole world through a pinhole. And indeed, we often see it more clearly by doing so. So there's a way in which one can turn the precision of scientific measurement and observation into something that will open up the world to us, rather than divide it into narrower and narrower perspectives.
Ahimè, 19:58, leggo sul mio. Ringraziamo moltissimo Tim Imbolc per essere qui, stato qui con noi, e grazie a tutti. Credo che avremo modo subito dopo stasera, nei giorni prossimi, nei mesi prossimi, chissà per quanto tempo ancora, di rielaborare molte di queste cose che sono state dette. Grazie. Approfitto per invitarvi già da ora al prossimo intervento di Peter Chienalto, sarà con l'artista sound artist Attila Faravelli, è previsto per giovedì 26 aprile qui alla GAM alle ore 18:30. A presto, grazie a tutti.